Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
What's up, everyone, and welcome back to the Master the Start podcast presented by GoMahi.com. This is episode number 24, so get excited about that. And before we jump into today's podcast episode, I just want to say sorry up front. We had some audio issues. It was either a corrupt file or our mics weren't quite working correctly. So we had to do a lot of work on the back end to actually make sure you could hear it. So bear with us and make sure you enjoy the show, because today we have Lee Hutton on the show and his partner in crime, Justin Evans. I am primarily going to give the bio of Lee because he is our main guest on the show and we were just lucky and blessed to have Justin join him. So here's Lee's background. Lee represents celebrities, athletes, and coaches in endorsement negotiations, player performance contracts, and business transactions, while also advising them on brand protection, and he deals with all of those threats. His client list contains professionals, amateurs, Paralympics, and Olympic athletes, along with entertainers, musicians, and celebrities. So he's kind of a big deal. Since 2014, Hutton has been recognized on the Minnesota Super Lawyers list, and he was named on the Rising Stars list in the 2008-2013 editions. Along with that, in 2010, he was selected as an Attorney of the Year by Minnesota Lawyers, which is an absolute honor. Basically, you might see him on the news all the time because he is on the news all the time. You might see him on TMZ because he's represented people like Chris Humphries against Kim Kardashian. He's represented Puff Daddy in the Super Bowl concert. He does all kinds of crazy things. This guy's a beast. And I think you're really going to enjoy this week's episode of Master the Start. So just like always, settle in, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or Google Play. You guys still aren't doing it. We're getting the listens, but you guys aren't subscribing. I'm watching like every other week. And pretty soon, I know I gave this warning last week, I'm going to start calling you guys out. So get ready. And most importantly, make sure you enjoy this week's episode of Master the Start. See you after the show. All right, so we got Lee and Justin on the show. Thank you guys for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Let's start with Justin. Can you tell us your background? Just really what makes you who you are?
Yeah, well, I'm like a St. Paul kid through and through. I grew up in St. Paul. I went to school in St. Paul. I went to undergrad at the U of M and law school there as well. And so I'm just trying to do my thing here in the Minnesota market that I love so much, and trying to both make my way in the world and, you know, try to make change where I find the opportunity to do so.
Cool. Lee, yeah. Your background's a little more extensive.
A little bit more different. I am a Houstonian by way of Houston, Texas. Came up here in 94 with a guy who coined the phrase Jizo Bizo, Jim Wacker, a longtime Gopher head coach. So I came up here to play football in 94.
Where's Jizo Bizo?
You know, we still don't know. But at least, Texas Lutheran minister turned football, but great individual. And he emphasized that Minneapolis, St. Paul market would be eventually their home if you come from out of state to live here. And he was very accurate on that. I went to William Mitchell College of Law after I kind of hung up my cleats, so to speak. And then upon graduating law school, I did some things in the community. I had some small companies just as a hobby for the most part. But then I went into working for your large law firms in town here. Which kind of brings us here with one of my colleagues and partners, because we just recently opened up Hutton Claus Evans, which is a boutique litigation consulting business firm in town here.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I know you have experience with athletes and celebrities. Yep. Have you done anything with athletes?
Well, I've worked with Lee. I mean, you know, Lee is great to work with because, unlike attorneys at big firms. I'd actually met Lee at one of these firms that we worked at together, and so I was toiling away in my office doing boring like insurance stuff, and all of a sudden Lee comes on the scene and he like grabbed me by the scruff of my neck and was like, "Here, here's what you're doing." And all of a sudden I was just like, you know, talking to like P. Diddy on the phone, and, you know, like Chris Humphries popping in my office, you know. And so it's like, oh, this is like a lot cooler than what I was doing before. And so yeah, I have experience doing that sort of entertainment stuff. Just because Lee really brought me in and took me under his wing. So
I'm kind of curious, within the entertainment world, do you have to treat them as clients or do things any differently? Because, I mean, you're doing things with celebrities, athletes, but you've also done things with Fortune 500 companies, sure, et cetera. How do you balance the way that you treat each individual? Is it significantly different? Is it all the same?
No, you know, everybody says, you know, you do entertainment litigation or entertainment law. What is that? And I said, well, it's the normal legal issue that collides on the steps of the courthouse. It just wears a sequins dress. That's all it is. So it really is no different. I mean, the issues that I have with the CEOs of top corporations are the same issues that Puff would call me on or Chris would call me on, whether it be divorce, whether it be extortion, whether it be a will, whether it be, you know, kind of the normal walks of life. So, yeah, it's a little exciting because of the name behind it, but really no different legal service.
Wasn't Chris and Kim's essentially your first family law?
It was my first divorce case, yeah. It was unique because Chris, who was a relatively new client, I actually met him on a plane heading out to the NBA All-Star Weekend in 2011. Before the plane landed, I had a client, and the first thing that he wanted to do was go to a party that he and Kim were hosting. At that party, Chris was being courted by a Chinese shoemaker. Well, fortunately, and this is the great Hopkins School District, my kids go to a Chinese immersion school and happen to teach me a little Chinese. So here I am negotiating this contract in a different language that Chris's current advisors could not do. Before that was over, I had a new client. Now, fast forward 2 months, their relationship got hot and heavy. They got married. I was at the wedding. Very interesting. A lot of celebrity people. And then 72 days later, we found out that Chris was divorced. Or Kim was divorcing Chris. We dealt with the PR and communication crisis, which is unique for an attorney to have to deal with, but still part of that communication that you want to provide to your client. And it was my idea in this first divorce case that we would respond with fraud action, which is really unheard of in the United States, that you would defend yourself in a divorce and seek annulment because the other person was not forthwith or forthright on their intentions to marry. And we came out very successful.
How do you prove something like that? I just don't even understand. And I guess this would kind of jump into what I kind of want to get into next. Yeah. This is for both of you guys. How do you guys form arguments?
Yeah,
like, what is the structure and how much time do you put into it? Because I think people don't realize, number one, you guys are the best ever at convincing someone to agree with you.
Sure.
And that is very relevant, not only in law, but also in sales.
Absolutely.
I mean, anywhere in the business world, having that ability is amazing.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to hear both of your guys' different takes on how you...
You want me to go first?
Yeah, go first. Okay. I didn't think about it a bit.
You know, honestly, I've been fortunate to have Justin. it's true. Because Justin knows I will immediately come up with, from a gut reaction, using cultural anthropology. When I first came up to Minnesota, I joined Norsky Torsky Kluban. So here I am, the only black guy in the room, actually learning about Ole and Lena and how Norwegians thought and Swedes thought. And then I'm in a courtroom in front of Norwegians and Swedes. And so I was able to change my communication so they can understand, especially when you have 6 to 12 people on the jury, how do you formulate one sentence that this case is about that is spoken in English, but six people derive it and receive it differently, but then conclude it the same. That's very difficult, and that's very strategic. So Justin and I often have many arguments about strategy, and ultimately Justin says, look, here it is, and I nine times out of ten go with Justin, says, because he's the king of the research. But a lot of the strategy gets formed by just sitting at the table, having a conversation, kind of putting ourselves in the shoes, and I know it kind of sounds cliche, but it's true, in the shoes of our client, understanding what their pain, their defenses, their fears are, translating that into the law, and then retranslating that to communicate to the jury. And we think of cases when we get a case in from trial backwards, because the one thing we want to do is kind of see if we can resolve this dispute very quickly. Sometimes that's not always the case, but we have to predict where this is kind of going. We're kind of legal entrepreneurs, legalpreneurs, if you will. And what I mean by that, if you're going to be a successful entrepreneur, I always tell them, never chase money because you're in a big crowd. If you want to be successful, you got to intercept it, which means you got to get there innovatively before the money starts coming to you. So what are the ideas that nobody's ever thought about that you can intercept that money coming in there? Similarly, the law, being a legal preneur, is how do we intercept that communication where we're teaching the jurors on how to think, how to act, and how to operate were there first. So that's how I do it.
Yeah, I sort of see forming arguments as kind of like a Rubik's Cube, where the whole goal, you have to think about what the goal is first. In the Rubik's Cube, the goal is to have all the colors aligned, right? And so there's all these pieces that come to making a persuasive argument. There's the facts that you have in a particular case. There's the law that you have. And then there's some practical considerations, right? And I like the puzzle of trying to see how each of those things can fit together to meet the strategy, right? And so I think that it's not that, you know, me or we are so inherently persuasive, but I think I have the luxury of sitting back in my chair and spinning around in a circle and thinking about it for a while until I can move the pieces all into place to end up at the goal that I want. So I really think that in terms of coming up with an argument, trying to be persuasive, just try to think it through. You know, that's it. Take my time with it. Think about what could go wrong. And move the pieces until it fits. Sometimes you just have to pound your fist on the table, though, and yell at a guy. So there's also that. You know, that's a practical piece of the puzzle.
And a scotch and cigar while you're thinking about it doesn't hurt.
So, I mean, that means you guys have to be very good at public speaking, essentially, because no one wants to listen to someone that's stumbling over their words. Have you always been good speakers, or did you slowly learn it?
Oh, I don't think I'm a good speaker now. I think it's interesting because people always say that to me, and they, you know, they just watched an episode of Boston Legal, and somebody gave a really like persuasive closing. But then I go to my, you know, my desk every day, and 95% of what I do is in writing. And so I'm a much better writer than public speaker. But, you know, Lee just has this gift of gab, you know, where he can just get up there and just go from nothing. And I always tell this story about Lee when I tell people, you know, about like what he does in the courtroom, and is that I once during trial, you know, the judge called for closing arguments just like that. And Lee stood up and said, "I'm ready." He grabbed a piece of paper off the desk, and he looked at it, and he just gave this, like, 40 or 50-minute, off-the-cuff, like, this speech. It was beautiful, including, like, 5 minutes of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And then he put the paper down, and I looked at the paper, and it was just blank. And I was like, what just happened?
I remember that one of the strategies is, you know, what you mentioned about thinking about it. We found out a lot of lawyers don't think about it. They take the case, they run the law, and they try to plug in facts, but not understanding why. And so in that particular case, which was a racial discrimination case we were defending, the other lawyer had no idea where she was going. And I knew she wasn't ready to give closing arguments. And so the judge said, "Well, do you guys need some time to prepare it?" So I jumped up and said, "No, I'm ready right now." And you should have seen the look at the other attorney. And so when I was done, She had not listened to what my argument was because she was trying to prepare her closing argument. And I can tell you, we were very successful in that. And by the way, where the Martin Luther King speech, it was a racial discrimination case with an African-American male. My reverse Martin Luther King speech was he was fired not because of the color of his skin, but the content of his character. And the judge agreed with us.
That's pretty cool. So how do you think playing football in college carried over into law?
You know, I think so. I played football at, some of the highest levels that you can ever get. And, I do think the intellectual stimulation and the competition in the courtroom completely surpasses what I ever did playing against 106,000 people in Michigan. And people laugh when I say that. But, when you have, and I've experienced this, where you're walking in the courtroom and your client says, I hope we win this case because if we don't, I'm going to kill myself. I've had that pressure. And you go in there and, by golly, you are the counselor for your client. You're the confidant. You give them a hug. And you go win, and that's the pressure that sometimes lawyers have. But I think football prepared me because, my Southern grandmother says I'm well-balanced because I got a chip on both shoulders. And so football's made me tough in that sense. It certainly has allowed me to kind of balance my time, being a student athlete where you're playing football 80 hours a week and you got to study on top of that. So pressure is nothing new to me. And quite frankly, I still get the mold where I walk in the courtroom and you get this out-of-body experience where you're just on. The lights go on. It's showtime. So I'm the greatest show in court when that happens. And quite frankly, people want to see a little Boston Legal in the courtroom. But they also want to see some intellectual ingenuity in how you communicate the cases. Because a lot of cases, quite frankly, when you're in the courtroom, are just plain boring.
So boring.
So boring.
Go to the courthouse and spend a day watching lawyers work, and you will spend half that day asleep.
That is actually true.
There's no showmanship in the law, or the instances of showmanship are often few and far between.
That's right.
And the people that do have showmanship, are they usually better off? Or no?
I think so. I mean, half the battle when you're trying to engage somebody over a long period of time is just keeping them interested. That's it. I mean, if you read a book and it's boring, maybe you lose interest, but if you read the book with the same content, but it's interesting and it sings a little bit instead of being, monotonous and dry, well, all of a sudden you retain more information. It has nothing to do with substance, but about presentation. So, I mean, form and substance have to go together hand in hand, but you can't sacrifice form in favor of pure, boring substance. Otherwise, you can't keep people's attention.
That's right. My take on the legal system is that it's imperfect to the point where it would never be perfect. If you have a serious legal issue that has occurred on for years, a month or whatever, for a long time, the plaintiff and defendant has lived that every day, every second of their life as this issue came to the courthouse. Then you compel 6 to 12 people to resolve that issue. And they're really resolving that issue in an extreme vacuum because they don't get to see all the communications that happen in the judge's quarters. They don't get to see the communications that happen at settlement conference. So really, they're basing their understanding of what the case is only by the presentation of the attorneys. And if the attorney's boring, you're going to lose. If the attorney can't communicate, you're going to lose. But not to mention, what kind of tricks and how can you communicate what happened where the jury didn't get to see? How do you get that in a question? How do you get that in an objection? I can tell you some of my strategies, and Justin has seen me, where I will object to a perfectly legal question because 9 times out of 10, the attorney hears my objection and they move on because they lacked confidence and they lacked control. But once a jury sees an attorney losing confidence, losing control, that gets imputed to their client. And so, quite frankly, I've seen many litigators who have been practicing for several decades, several years, with very little experience trying cases.
Hmm. Pretty interesting.
It's kind of scary too. Lawyers get, it's hard to evaluate how good a lawyer is. Because if you settle, a lot of times you settle and you're very happy, you settle a case and you're very unhappy or dissatisfied. That's a decision that you and your lawyer made for better or for worse to settle. When you go to trial, you know you won, right? And that's on the verdict form. That's where six people said, hey, you did it or you didn't do it. You're responsible or you didn't, or you're not responsible. Or they ask for $1 million, you only get to pay $30,000. You can measure that. And I do think, trial litigators have to be extreme risk takers because that defines your career. I've been fortunate enough to try well over 70 cases to verdict. Many attorneys shy away from that because you're defined by wins and losses. Even Justin, at his ripe age, has tried more cases than probably your senior attorney out there. And a lot of it is just building that confidence and understanding that you have outthought the competition. If I'm Clemson University, sorry, the football pun, the number one team in the nation, and I'm well prepared, I should never be scared to play against the top 300 team in the country. And so we take it, Hutton Claus Evans, as our ability because we've had proven results. We've been in the courtroom. The judges know us. We kind of know the tactics. We've been there, done that before. Is that we can try a case against anybody in the country and come out very successful.
So why exactly? I know you told me before. Why did you guys break off and make your own firm?
Yeah, I'll let Justin answer this too. For me, and I tell people the Jerry Maguire moment where I'm walking out of my office, fishbowl in hand, and saying to myself, there has to be a better way to provide services to clients. And when I mean services, I mean cost-efficient litigation where you're not paying $600, $700 an hour, where you're not seeing bills that are hundreds of thousands of dollars for 1 month because somebody went through discovery. That happens at many law firms, unfortunately. You're not getting reports and understanding why the strategy is the case because the concept of these multi-mega teams to do this multi-mega litigation, I think destroys the opportunity to really have some independent thought with the person who's going to try the case. And so you have a bunch of lower-level individuals, paralegals, younger associates, who are doing the significant brunt of the work, and then the attorney who's going to eventually try the case doesn't pick up the file until the last minute. When that happens, that attorney has to make a decision, am I honestly prepared? And so I can tell you, and I think what some of your listeners are like, golly, that happened to me. I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then when I got to the courthouse steps, my attorney says, we're going to settle. And I said, why did we come this far? I was paying $200,000+ to settle on the courthouse steps. Aren't you ready? Behind the scenes, that's what's happening. So what I envisioned and what we did with myself, Steve Claus, and Justin Evans, is that we team up with the head partners of the firm. We do your work. The hours and what we bill by hour is significantly lower than your $700. We also engage in kind of my experience in trying cases. I can look at a case and say, this is what it's going to be. It's going to cost you $150,000 from start to finish. And people say, well, how can you be so sure? Aren't you going to work more or are you going to work less? I can be so sure with precision because of the experience I've had. So I can usually eyeball a complaint, know who the other lawyer is, and say, this is how much it's going to be. So now if you're a small business person or even a large corporation and you know that this case is going to cost you $150,000 from start to finish, you don't have these runaway bills, and you can put it on your P&L statement, you can budget your company without any surprises. The worst thing that legal consumers get is that they get this fictitious estimate of a budget of $150,000. But then by the time the case is over, they spent $500,000. You know, that is not providing legal service. So what we wanted to do is erase those kind of dilemmas that a legal consumer would have, partner with them a little bit more, kind of engage them as if we were their in-house general counsel, resolve disputes effectively and efficiently, number one, to where if anybody wanted to sue them again, they'll know that Hutton Claus Evans is their attorneys and they'll think twice when that happens. Number two is that we can kind of look under the hood while we are giving litigation advice and then provide some preventative consultation to prevent lawsuits going forward as well. So with all that, we're kind of your in-house legal counsel that you can hire but not pay the benefits to. You don't have to pay health insurance or anything like that. And I think you get a better service. I certainly will stand by the fact that you get better results.
Yeah, I wanted to go out on my own for a long time just because I was sort of tired of the status quo. Big law firms are sort of slow to respond to change, and they do some things that I, as a millennial, just wasn't that interested in doing. You know, they have the high overhead, bloated structure, really hierarchical, tons of hours, and that just wasn't working for me. I think that the law in the future is absolutely going to change. I kind of want to have a more personal relationship with my clients. I don't want my clients to be scared to pick up the phone because I have to bill them at such a high rate to afford the penthouse suites in these office buildings downtown. You know, I much prefer having people call me on my cell phone. We have a 10-minute conversation about a small issue that they're having, and it builds confidence, and I enjoy helping them, and they don't necessarily get charged for the small-time stuff. And because of that, I have a larger number of more intimate relationships with these clients, and it actually feels like I'm affecting real change as opposed to just, shoving the billable hour down their throats. And they're hesitant to call me, and they only call me when it's a crisis, when they should have called me 3 months ago. So now I'm out here with the flexibility to do whatever it takes to make sure that people get the legal services they need, and that's that, as simple as that.
So you just brought up relationships, which I think is probably the most important thing in your business.
Absolutely.
Before you take on a case of any type, do you have to feel like you're tied to that? Like you have to feel calling to it? Do you have to really believe in it in order to back them fully? Because where I'm going with this is I think about medicine, for example. They end up becoming so good at their job that they can become detached from their patient.
True.
The patient is a product, in a sense, that they need to fix, and being detached allows them to do their job better, because they don't feel that emotional pull. Now, in law, is it that same thing? Can you guys leave work and basically become unattached from the people you're representing, or do you become so attached that you actually feel that pain with them when you're representing?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Unlike medicine, the law is, at least what we do, is adversarial, right? So on the one hand, even if it's something I don't necessarily agree with, I can champion that person's cause fully, be detached, just because I'm working within a system that requires that. So let's say there's a product out there, and it's poorly designed, and it's hurting people. Well, to what degree should the fact that it's a poorly designed product automatically mean that this company go out of business, or is there something short of that? And so let's say I don't believe that this product is particularly good. Well, I can get behind the fact that the person who designed the product should only pay what's fair in the situation, right? So I can fully believe in the justice of the situation, even though I don't necessarily agree with the way that the product was designed, right? So there's both an attachment and a lack of attachment that exists in the system.
Yeah, that's 100% true. I think individually I've have kind of grown into what my father, we were talking earlier about medicine. My father's a urologist, and he was the type of doctor, you know, back when the insurance companies would pay, and sometimes they didn't pay, where he would sleep in his patient's room the entire night just so they can feel kind of the service and, you know, all these, you know, things that are scary for somebody in a situation to have your doctor there. And he coined the phrase, caring is preparing. And I often, to a certain extent, especially I've gotten some very controversial cases that will end people's careers if we're not successful, cases where people would lose their 50-year company, a products liability case that we defended successfully, where you had a guy who inherited his grandfather's company, and the company's been around for 50 years, had a products liability suit, and he comes to us on trial. He says, if I settle, the company's done. If we lose this case, the company's done. And I had to hug him and said, we're not going to lose. And we ended up winning. And I don't think we won the case because of the legal analysis. We won the case because we showed that we were compassionate, we cared for our client. And to a certain extent, I know this kind of sounds like a bad scene from Ghost, but our clients usually use our bodies as a conduit to speak to the jury. And that is so true. If there is pain or anger or any emotion that we have to reflect so the jury can understand what our clients can go through, you best believe that it's going to come out in my opening, or it's going to come out in my questioning or my closing. So I think that's far too true. And I think many attorneys now, and I get critical on the profession because I think the profession can do better, is that we forget that real people are involved with this. And we forget that, you know, the case may end for us, but it goes on forever for the client. And lawyers have to do better not to forget that. They have to do better in the sense that we are the champions of social justice. So a lot of the cases that may seem minor that are getting sued out, you know, I've defended sexual harassment claims. I pursued sexual harassment claims. I've been on both sides of the fence and successful on both sides. And, you know, we forget that those cases that go in the courtroom basically rearrange how we interact with people in society. And that is how important lawyers are in the everyday walks of life of people, whether we accept it or not. You know, we're the profession that changed the civil rights movement. We're the profession that is dealing with issues that are social issues that are making people diametric in how they react to each other. I mean, they're getting resolved by the Supreme Court, right? And, you know, that is something that I think our firm has taken seriously, that we embody, that, you know, it's not just about the client, it's about the future of the client.
Interesting. So can you guys both tell me your biggest losses? Essentially,
I don't have any. Go ahead.
Gosh,
I'm actually not sure because winning and losing, it's so, like, that's such a black and white concept. But often, you don't come in. You know, it's not as though every case has the equal chance of success, right? Mm-hmm. So you might come in with a case that has terrible facts, mm-hmm. and essentially, it's about how you measure the success. So if you get this case that has terrible facts, but the outcome isn't quite as terrible as it might be, you know, is that a win? Is that a loss, even though the outcome is bad? And so I wouldn't say that there's been a moment in my career where I've had this, like, crushing defeat where I thought I should have won outright, absolutely, and then didn't achieve that goal. I think there's a lot more gray area in there than people expect when they talk about attorneys, like, battling over a case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, fortunately, in those moments when we have had the black and white I've been able to be successful and achieve the right result.
I think, you know, this is going to sound maybe like I'm preaching on the mountaintop, and maybe I am. I think the only losses I've had in my career, which goes back to your first question, why we opened our own firm, is individuals that have sought me out specifically because they saw me on TV or they read about me, and we were not able to take their case because they couldn't afford us. I think that is the biggest loss. And the reason why I say that is because there are so many individuals that are not able to take advantage of the legal system, either because they can't pay for proper defense or they cannot get a lawyer to take their case to pursue because the money is not there enough. And so this gives us the flexibility to kind of take people and help them out. And I hate the word pro bono, and I do the word obligation. I think it's our obligation as lawyers to make sure that everybody has access. So, for example, our firm is doing some work for the Safety Project, and the Safety Project is connected to the Harriet Tubman Center, and I've been doing this for years. And it's an organization that seeks lawyers to volunteer to help individuals that are in domestic dispute situations, sexual assault situations, getting OFPs. And those are the ones that I feel most gratified, because a lot of times people who are pursuing those type of actions can't afford an attorney to be by their side, so they're doing it themselves. And when they do it themselves, they're questioning, as a lawyer would, the person who just beat them up or the person who sexually assaulted them. And I can't imagine anybody being emotionally able to do that without an attorney guiding them. So we're doing, as we're sitting here, I just got an email from the Safety Project thanking us for, you know, continuing to provide those services, and thanking me specifically in the last case that we won, where a young woman was basically held captive by her significant other. And, I mean, just terrible situations. But, again, I think it goes away from the pro bono, but the obligation that lawyers have to our society.
I don't even know how I could sit in that room looking across that table at someone like that. Yeah. Like, I just... That's insane.
It's pretty profound. I mean, doing cases like that, it's never more apparent that the work that lawyers do affects real people. Mm-hmm. The most profound moment of my entire life was when I was in law school working at the clinic. So you're working as a lawyer, but you haven't yet graduated law school. And I did this expungement of this woman's criminal record because she couldn't get a job because she had too many convictions on her record. And the story was that at one point in her life, she was addicted to drugs and turned to prostitution in order to feed her drug habit, right? Now, fast forward all these years, and it still haunts her, and she completely turned her life around, so much so that she was now an advocate for women who were going through a similar situation. And it was just heartbreaking that she couldn't do anything to change her situation. Every time she would try to reach up, you know, the system would bring her back down. She couldn't get jobs. She couldn't get housing. She couldn't get services. And it, like, not only affected her, but it affected her ability to help these other women because she couldn't get the licensure for the type of profession that she wanted. She couldn't do X, Y, and Z. And she tried to get her record expunged, and she, on her own, without the services of an attorney, and she just couldn't. She couldn't navigate the system. She didn't have the time. She didn't have the money. She didn't have the know-how. And she came to the clinic, and I worked with her, and I wrote this petition for her. She had something like 25 or 27 convictions, you know, from back in the day. And I wrote this petition for her, and I remember sitting in a tiny conference room, you know, 8x8, around a small round table. And as she read this petition that I'd written for her, telling the story of her life and how she'd been, how she transformed it and how she'd been reformed, she literally just sat there and cried because somebody took the time to tell her story in a way that she couldn't. And she could never have put that petition together on her own. And then when we got her record expunged, it changed her whole life. It was such a profound moment to me that, like, I remember it, even though it was years ago, I remember it like crystal clear as day.
So then how do you guys deal with stress? And I'm curious because, I mean, like you said, in some of your cases, you've legitimately had clients say, if I lose this thing, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are not only taking on the weight of your own problems, you're taking on the weight of other people's problems, and my you have wife, to do it well.
My wife would love to come in here and answer that question. In a human response, I personally could do better dealing with it because I cannot sleep. I don't sleep if there is a pressing issue for my client. Justin has seen, and he's done it to me, and I do it to him, just text at the middle of the night. You know, hey, here's an idea, or what are you doing? And I'm up watching TV because I can't sleep. You know, and that is goes into the caring. I try to get to Mexico as much as possible. My wife is the only female owner, the only immigrant owner, and the only minority owner of a cigar lounge that's opening in a new location in Ember Grove Heights. So a lot of times you'll see me there with a cigar and a scotch. So, you know, that's relaxing for me. And I have three kids that are very active in sports and very good in band and some other activities. So, you know, I kind of give back. So I was coaching. I got to tell this story because it's fun. I was coaching youth basketball, and all the kids in my team were kids who were rejected by the Traveling Basketball Association because they were too small. And we started the season pretty much losing the first half of the games, every last one of them. But when it came to tournament time, we whooped everybody and ended up winning the tournament with kids who were told they were too small, kids who said they were told they couldn't make it by local travel teams, and they ended up beating everybody. And it was so rewarding that these kids learned how to work as a team, that they were kind of that tough nut to crack, persistence. And I can tell you, and I'm pretty intense. I traveled the Hopkins basketball travel team to play our team. And I haven't heard it back from. So that's rewarding, kind of giving back and showing kids that despite what people are telling you, that you can certainly go beyond other people's expectations and boundaries that they put on you.
How do you deal with stress, Justin?
I've just sort of accepted the fact that I'm going to die 20 years earlier than otherwise, because of the lack of sleep. And like, I have all this gray hair, even though it's like too much for like a person of my age. It's kind of a bummer. But to be honest, like when I'm feeling particularly stressed out, it really helps me to sort of just take a breath and acknowledge that it is my job to not take on the type of stress that the client has. When the client is worried about losing their business, well, that's not that causes me stress personally, but I don't have the stress because it's not my business, right? And so it's a little bit of a different kind of stress. It's a degree removed. While I'm very much there and I want to do my absolute best for that client to make sure that he doesn't lose his livelihood, it is my job to not be stressed out about that thing so much that I lose focus and the ability to achieve the result that is necessary. You know, I mean, that's my job, is to internalize that stress and sort of just push it down and make sure that it doesn't affect me. And then I just deal with it later.
That's really cool. So I have one more question before we get into the quick fire questions. And
who knew that was going to be part of this?
So how do you guys balance, or I'm really curious, how does the structure work within the firm when you are not only focused on law, but you also have to balance this idea of running a business at the same time? Like, how do you even market a law firm? How do you do all of it?
Right.
Or do you not know yet?
Well, I think that's a little bit true. You know, this firm's pretty young. However, you know, the law is an interesting business, and especially as a litigator, because people come to us when they need us, because for the most part, people can't navigate the legal system, right? You need somebody to advocate for you. And so there's sort of a built-in clientele in that way. You know, in the society that we live in, it's very litigious. And so, you know, there's always somebody who is being sued. There's always somebody who wants to sue to, you know, enforce their rights. So focusing on the law has allowed us to just get business in the door, and it's been sort of just organic. To date, we haven't had like a particularly like well thought out business model. You know, I think what we're doing is focusing on making sure that we're offering the best client service that we can, and the business part sort of just, you know, solves itself.
Cool.
Well, for me, this phase comes with a built-in PR company. So I'm always marketing. I mean, if I'm passing out business cards, yes, you know, I will walk in a room and come out with clients. And because this, I always say, as long as there's imperfect people in this world, there will always be need for lawyers. And anytime I walk in a room, there's somebody in that room with this hidden secret that a lawyer can resolve. And so if I'm at a bar, if I'm at a function, or where I am, interestingly, you know, those people either seek me out or I seek them. I've been fortunate enough to have a collection of cases that always end up on TMZ or something like that. So if you Google my name in TMZ or something like that, you probably did. You probably saw, you know, I've represented Robert Hershovec from Shark Tank, from Chris Humphries to Tyga the Rapper. I mean, you name it. And so, interestingly, I think a lot of clients think it's kind of cool that I got Chris Humphries' lawyer. So that first divorce case actually has sprinkled many other divorce cases after that. And if there's a good fight, I'm there. So that's been kind of our marketing right now. We're kind of looking forward to the spring, where people are in Minnesota are actually out and about to really kind of advertise what we do for services, something ingenuitive and unique. And I think the way law firms are providing services is going to shift to the model that we're proposing. I do strongly see that, where you have attorneys being obligated to bill 2,000 hours. So if you know that your attorney is obligated to bill 2,000 hours a year, it makes you a little worried that he's working on your file, because he's probably going to find hours that are not necessary to bill you and others so he can make up that 2,000 hours. We're not about that. We're about really getting to the goals, because the more successful we are, the better relationships that we're building, we're going to have sustainable clients that lead us forward. And quite frankly, if you have a good business that's producing results, you'll be successful financially.
Cool. And I said that was the last question before quick fire questions, but now I'm going to beat myself up if I don't ask another one. How do you guys create realism? So I got to imagine you have clients that expect to get way more than what they're actually going to get, and then you have to figure out how to actually ask for the right amount.
Yeah.
Where does that even come from? Where do you start? How does that work?
I think it's easier to create expectations for a client who you're defending, because when you get a summons complaint that says you have to pay in excess of $50,000 or $1 million or whatever the complaint says, that's a scary situation, because if people in our society can't pay for their own health care, the last thing they can pay for is that type of cash money, especially if insurance is not covering it. That's a scary proposition. But if we're able to come in there and get far less than what's been asked, the defendant thinks that's a huge victory. And I've also been one of those attorneys, in Minnesota it's actually been very useful, that I'll tell the other side that you better get ready for trial, because I'm going to dismiss this case completely, either by summary judgment or because I'm going to win at trial. And it's interestingly, going back to a further discussion, so many attorneys don't have trial experience that they will reduce what the case is actually worth significantly to not go to trial. And so I take advantage of that. The other side is the plaintiff's side is where they're seeking money. That's when the expectations can be all over the place, because you want to caution the kid, your client not to expect this to be a lottery situation. Understanding Minnesotans, Minnesotans are still very so stoic. They have no problem with finding accountability and liability. However, how much they will give you for somebody being accountable is far lower than what you would see in some other jurisdictions around the country. So you have to caution that with them. But on the other side, you know, being real and getting your client to understand what is real is really just having blatant, candid conversations with your client. And not, I don't believe in the term underselling, over-delivering. I don't believe in that concept. I believe in this is what the case is worth. I'm going to be within 5% margin of that. And that's because of my experience. That's because how talented we are as a firm. And that's what we deliver to you. And if something kind of changes that philosophy, we love our clients so much that we're going to be in constant communication to explain why that is. So we're not that firm that's going to be underselling, over-delivering, or overselling and under-delivering. No, you're going to get exactly, we want you to end up where our legal analysis began.
Yeah, so I think you answered that pretty clearly, but then is there like an industry average on like what you're going to get on certain cases? Because I'm just thinking about, like, for example, I think about Chris and Kim. Yeah. They're humans like everyone else, so I don't really like bringing them out. But like, that's a unique situation.
Right.
So how do you determine with every unique situation what the proper amount is? Like, is it based off of percentages? Is it very analytical, or is there a lot of emotion involved too?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I can't disclose exactly what the settlement was because it was confidential. But I can say in a lot of cases, it's a little bit what you said. There's percentage is very analytical. But then if I take a deposition of somebody and their attorney is there and determine that they can't tell their story correctly, I don't care what the liability is. I don't care who's at fault. I take advantage of that. And so a lot of times the attorney you hire is going to be directly related to the results you get. And so when you hire Lee Hutton, you know, to pursue a claim, you're probably going to get a couple of dollars more than what the case is worth. If you hire Lee Hutton to defend a claim, you're probably going to not have to pay exactly what it is. And the reason why I can say that so strongly and so boldly is that's where the analysis come in. So it's a lot of factors. I don't know if there's ever a real number. You'll sue a case out for the same facts that another person will sue out and not get the same result for a lot of different reasons because the law is imperfect. And quite frankly, lawyers, myself, I take advantage of those imperfections in our legal system to put our client in the position that I want them to be in.
And I know these are probably really stupid questions, but is it essentially like buying a house? You go high and you're willing to slowly settle more and more, or is it you go in with the offer that you're only willing to take? And you were going to say something else off of that.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, creating a realistic expectation with your client to me is a lot like diagnosing an illness, right? Like you can go on WebMD and you type in your symptoms, but you're always going to get a more accurate answer if you go see your physician, right? Because that person, that doctor, he has the experience. He's seen what you have before, and he also has the access to the research and the know-how. And that's what attorneys do. And then you can watch Judge Judy and think that, you know, you have an understanding of how, like, a landlord-tenant dispute should be settled. But in reality, we have more experience doing these types of cases. And when you do them every day, it's easy for you to say, oh, look, I've done 10 cases with this exact same fact pattern. I'm guessing that the 11th case is going to come out the same way. You know, and in terms of how you practically go in and try to settle a case or assess a case, I mean, it really does depend on the facts. You know, if you there are times when you walk in to mediation and you have your number and you can just put it down on the table and say, look, this is what we want. This is it. I'm not going to entertain any other offers. You can either take it or leave it. But depending on the other side, maybe you highball them. You know, I don't know. You know, there's no magic formula. You just have to trade on the fact that we have been there before and have an understanding of how the game is played in order to, I think, get to the end point.
Cool. Okay, now we can go into the quick fire. And these are going to... I'm very interested because we have not had two people on the podcast at the same time. So I'm interested to see how your guys' answers are different. Number one, we always start with a very random question from our audience. So this week's random question, if you were wrongfully put into an insane asylum, how would you convince them that you're actually sane and not just pretending to be sane?
You take that one first.
That's hilarious. I think I would put enough trust into the people in the insane asylum to diagnose me properly, and I would just act normally.
So you're going to be there forever.
No, I think, you know, I honestly believe that people who are, you know, in the insane, like running the asylum, who are licensed and capable of telling people who are truly troubled mentally and who aren't, mm-hmm. I think that they would be able to see that I don't belong there over some period of time.
I like it.
I'm going to be there forever because I would argue, and then I would just conform to my surroundings and watch Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest over and over again until I get kicked out and go to another same asylum in which I'll find the one that I can just escape.
I love how this is the exact story of like the Joker from Batman.
It is. He's
like,
of course it is.
Okay. Good stuff. So our audience, primarily business professionals, so think about them for a moment when I ask you these following three questions. But, I mean, you can also apply it to law. It doesn't matter. What skills do you guys believe a young professional needs to have straight out of college? And we were kind of talking about school before this. So.
Sure. I think you have to be a risk taker these days. I think you have to have the skill to come out of your own shell and not be scared to be limited. So that's one. I think you got to be able to communicate. What I mean by communicate, not necessarily being able to speak, but understand how to engage multiple type of cultural, local cultural, international cultural. I think you have to be a cultural anthropologist, and I think that's a skill these days. And then third, I really think the skill of just being a genuine person helps as well. I think we've lost genuine people. And if you have a product that is going to revolutionize the world, it's going to deliver great service, and you're genuinely about thinking about doing that and providing the service for people, I think you'd be successful. I think those are three important skills to have.
I think the only skill that makes any difference is critical thinking. The ability to put your bias aside, assess the situation, and think critically about what the situation means, what the outcomes could be. I think if people did more critical thinking, I think the world would be a far different place.
Sweet. Okay, third quick fire. What do you have to give up to become successful?
Sleep. You have to give up sleep. If you really want to be successful and be good at what you do, you're going to have to eat, breathe, prepare, engage, and unfortunately, sometimes just giving up a little sleep.
Yeah, my answer is going to be time. Same concept. If you want to be successful at something, I'm convinced you can't half-ass it. You got to whole-ass it.
Yeah.
And that means you have to do it. You got to be there. You got to be present to win. So I think in order to really become successful, you got to make sure you're spending the time on it.
I can't say I've heard the term whole asset before.
I never either.
But
I'm pretty sure I didn't coin it.
I don't know. It's
it just sounds weird.
You can't say you have to asset. Put the hole in there. It's contest to have asset.
Okay, when it comes, I just want to quickly dive into that. So you said sleep. You said time. Now, when you say sleep, I think a lot of people, a lot of millennials, a lot of Gen Zers will be like, So I have to go from my 12 hours to 10 hours of sleep. But I don't think that's what you necessarily mean. And when it comes to time, I don't think you necessarily mean instead of working 6 hours a day, you work eight. Right. So I'm kind of curious what you guys kind of define as time and sleep.
Yeah, you know, what I mean by giving up sleep is when I set out on this new venture even now, and even before, because I've owned other companies, I was partner at the large law firms, and to become successful, you're going to have to outwork the other person, and that requires time and hours. And so typically, I do about 5 to 6 hours of sleep a night, and that's on a good night, because I'm up, I'm watching TV, maybe even music, and not just to be relaxing, but I like to see what our society is thinking, because a lot of times I can get inspiration of what people are engaging to kind of put into my closing argument. So I'm learning a lot of times I'm writing, I'm thinking, I'm analytical, I'm making analysis, and I just can't do that if I'm dormant. And I do think the person who outworks the other person is going to be more successful. And what you have to give up, at least in my experience, is some sleep.
Well, I always think about it this way. Time is finite. There's 24 hours in a day. And you have to think about how you're going to prioritize how you spend that time, right? And I think if you want to be successful, you have to prioritize the time spent on the thing that you want to be successful at. And that means it's to the exclusion of time spent doing other things. I mean, you could easily try to produce a mediocre result in a smaller amount of time, or you could take that mediocre result and make it excellent if you spend more time at it. But what that means for you is maybe you're spending less time with your family, or maybe you're going on fewer vacations, or maybe you're reading fewer books or listening to less music. You know, something's got to give, and I think that thing is the time you spend doing leisure activities or the activities that truly like give you pleasure that aren't the thing you're trying to be successful at.
Right.
All right, last question. What is one life hack our listeners can apply to their lives this week? What is one action they can take to improve their lives?
Honestly, this goes back to critical thinking. Think things through before you act on them, and you'll find that it's a far more efficient way to live, even though it might take a little bit more time on the front end. I think it makes things easier on the tail end.
And how do they do that?
Well, because have you ever tried to do something just like, I'm struggling to find an analogy here, but where like the concept would be, you try to do something and you kind of like try to take the easy way out of it, but then you end up creating more work for yourself because you did that. Where if you really would have like thought about it, maybe you would have realized without having to endure the hardship that, oh, I should just do this the right way so as not to have to do it twice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I can't think of an example right now, but before I do almost anything, I think about, well, what's it going to look like if I just go, you know? And if I just think about it, maybe I change a little thing, and all of a sudden, instead of 3 steps, it's 1 step. Or I think like getting dressed in the morning is easy. It's like I can go into the bedroom and like just put on my boxers first, but then I'm like, oh, well, then my suit coat is downstairs, and so like instead of going through all the locations and trying to find like where the things are that I need to get ready for my day, I can think about it critically and determine like, hey, look, here's the order I need to do things in. If I just thought about it, I could do it faster than if I just ran around scrambling and did things randomly.
Cool.
I think for people, they have to look into their soul and learn how to dance in the rain. And what I mean by that is, if you're thinking about a new business or a new opportunity or just even changing your life, what makes you happy? You know, find out really what makes you happy, because every time I talk to, and we get to talk to a lot of people that confide in us, they're doing businesses or they're doing something that honestly is just waking up and doing, and they don't seek enjoyment. And the one powerful thing, I guess this goes to Justin with the critical thinking, that we have our mind to think of new concepts and new ideas, to make a widget or to make a service or to do something to better ourselves in the world. And the only thing that is stopping us is that opportunity to say, okay, what is going to make me happy? And then once you find that, then you think whether or not critically if you can monetize it. Because, you know, there's endless possibilities out there for you to make money. Who would have thought that, an app for a car to come pick you up that you can attach to your credit card called Uber would ever be something that successful? I mean, there's so many ideas that we look back and say, God, I wish I didn't think of that. Why didn't I think about that? Well, that's because you didn't stop and learn how to dance in the rain. You know, somebody did it before you did.
Sweet. Well, thank you guys for joining us on the Massive of Start podcast.
Love you. It, thank especially you. The rapid fire portion.
Oh, great.
Thank you.
Once again, like always, thank you for joining us on this week's episode of Massive of Start. I hope you enjoyed that podcast episode as much as I did. Some quick reminders from this podcast before I let you go. Number one, Lee shares 3 traits successful college students should have out of college. And those are being okay with risk and discomfort, communicating effectively with a diverse group of people, and being a genuine person. Number two, this week, most importantly, this is your thing this week, bring critical thinking into your daily life to make things more efficient. Starting this week, try to make this a habit in your everyday life. It's pretty simple. Just take all of those things, or those 2 specific things, into account this week. Have a wonderful week. Enjoy the next 7 days, and we'll see you next Monday.